Welcome to a Tales from the South encore presentation. From February of 2013, here's Tin Roof Project number 30 with Simeon Wright.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Finger Food with Steve Davison and Mickey Rigby? Steve and Mickey are American fingerstyle guitarists from Little Rock, Arkansas. When they aren't picking and grinning, they are working in marketing and banking. Steve also tours nationally with Artistry of the Guitar with Ken Bonfield, and his music is available at iTunes, CD Baby, and online at stevedavison.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has performed at legendary King Biscuit Blues Festival in Helena, Arkansas, among many other festivals nationwide. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Tonight's featured artist is painter Doug Norton, with his portrait of newly elected for his second term President Barack Obama right here behind me. And this piece is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Simeon Wright is the author of the moving Lawrence Hill Books memoir, Simeon's Story, an eyewitness account of the kidnapping of Emmett Till. A popular public speaker who addresses audiences at schools, churches, and cultural institutions throughout the country, Mr. Wright is one of the world's greatest authorities on what many call the most significant civil rights case in history. As a champion for justice and a witness to history, Mr. Wright works to share the truth of racism's evils. By educating the public, he remains a guardian of the legacy left by Emmett's mother, Mamie Till, and others who've used Emmett's name and story to remind Americans of the need for social change. Mr. Wright has appeared on CNN, Chicago Public Radio, The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, CBS's 60 Minutes, in the New York Times, Chicago Sun-Times, USA Today, and the Chicago Tribune, among others. He was a guest on Capitol Hill, where he and his wife Annie witnessed the passing in 2008 of the Till Bill, judicial legislation named in Emmett's memory. Mr. Wright was invited, along with key civil rights leaders, to witness a vote in Washington on lynching legislation, which he eagerly supported. Originally from Money, Mississippi, Simeon Wright lives in Chicago, Illinois, with his wife Annie. This show is made possible by William F. Lehman Public Library in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Humanities Traveling Exhibit for All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. Tonight, Simeon takes us back to the night of one of the most notorious cases of injustice in the 1950s segregated South. Ladies and gentlemen, Simeon Wright.
Paula, thank you. Everyone, thank you for inviting me out tonight. So far, I've enjoyed myself, my wife Annie, and I. I don't know. Back in the cotton fields of Mississippi, I never thought something like this would happen. Sitting in a room full of white folks? Whoever heard of such a thing? We didn't do that under Jim Crow. No. But I'm here to share part of the story of my life, excerpts from my personal memoirs, Simeon's Story. I wrote the book for one reason, is to correct the myth that's out there. There's a lot of things that's out there that's not true. So if you want the full truth, I would encourage you to tell your kids to buy you Simeon's Story for your Christmas present. Or you can purchase it tonight, autographed copy. Is that all right? I like the name of the Starving Artist Cafe. It reminds me of my wife. She has a bird feeder. And my wife, she doesn't like to get up in the morning like me. So I was up one morning fixing my breakfast, and I'm looking at the birds. I said, talking to the birds, of course, looking out my window, I said, "You're waiting on my wife, Annie, huh?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "Well, you're going to starve to death." She doesn't get downstairs till around 10 a.m. But life has been good. I told someone today, the only thing I would change in my life is August 28, 1955. If I could change that, I would change it. I can't change it. It's part of me. I'm going to read part of this story to you. I've never performed a reading before. I was talking to my wife. I don't know if anybody, anyone in here ever hear of Shambach? R.W. Shambach? I wished I could read like him. All of you English teachers, pardon my grammar. My older brother, this is the way he talked. Shambach is the best that ever done it. But I'm going to do my best. It all began in Money, Mississippi. Money, Mississippi is a little town. It's about 10 miles to the north of Greenwood. August of 1955. I grew up in the Jim Crow system. And the Jim Crow system is simply a short way of saying that everything was segregated, separate but equal. Separate schools, water fountains, cafes, churches, even the cemeteries were separate. Our contact with the white people was very limited. If there was any contact, it was initiated by the whites only. The rules of separation were enforced in the three theaters in Greenwood, Mississippi. This is the city we went to on Saturday night. The Paramount Theater reserved their downstairs for the whites. Blacks had to go upstairs. The other two theaters was the Dixie Theater and the Brooksie Theater. But the most hurtful things about the Jim Crow system was in the criminal justice system. Whites could beat us, even murder us, and nothing was ever done. It wasn't unusual for white farmers to hire black women as cooks or domestics, then force them into a sexual relationship, which is nothing more than rape. Very little was said or done about this. We had no rights in the court of law. Our economic plight was not much better. Most of the residents there lived where I lived were sharecroppers. Here's how it worked. Sharecropping, the landowner would plant the cotton crops in the spring, usually in April. The sharecroppers would live on the land and cultivate the cotton crops. Chopping cotton was a term for cultivating. I hated chopping cotton. It was more strenuous than picking. I would rather pick cotton any day than chop. After the cotton was harvested, it was sold. From the sale of the cotton, the landowner would take a share of this money to cover his expenses. In our cases, this included rent for the house we lived in, electric costs of the house, cotton seeds, planting equipment, and the rest was split 50-50. Now, it is July the 1st, 1955. Chopping cotton is done. From July to late August is what we call the lay-by, a time of waiting for the cotton to mature. During that time, Dad got a letter from the family of one of his parishioners who wanted him to give the eulogy. That is what brought Dad to Chicago in August of 1955. On Dad's return home, Emmett Till, also known as Bobo, and my nephew, Wheeler Parker Jr., came back with him for a summer vacation. One of our greatest thrills was to have relatives to visit us from the north. We had a lot of visitors from up north in the summer of 1955. My youngest sister, Loretha, came down in July to visit. My brother, Willie, came home on leave from the military that same year, just before Emmett and Wheeler arrived. Willie had just finished basic training in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. It didn't matter whether we're old or young, we look forward to the stories about the North. Everything from them were different, the clothes they wore, the way they talked. I had 1,000 questions to ask Bobo, and I knew he was prepared to answer them all. Was he taller than I? Was he still full of life? What about Chicago? Was it true that you could walk up and down South Water Market Street? Have your pick of all kinds of fruit? Was River Route Park as big as my brother Morris had said? Morris had gone to Chicago more recently in 1954, and he tried to explain to us the marvels of River Route Amusement Park. I wanted to know what Bobo had to say about these things. Everything that when Bobo arrived, he would be the center of attraction. Emmett and Wheeler arrived in our house on Saturday, August 20th, 1955. Mom made the sleeping arrangement. Emmett and I would sleep in the bedroom behind theirs. Robert would sleep in the bed on the west wall. We would share the front guest room with Maurice. Emmett, 14 years of old, he weighed about 140 pounds. He had big hazel eyes with sandy hair, kind of stuttered when he talked. But he used that affliction to his advantage. He was a great storyteller. He would pay boys to tell him jokes. George Gobel was his favorite comedian. He had no sense of danger. What was dangerous to us was fun to him. His cat, Jason, climbed up the tree one day. So Emmett got this grand idea of rescuing his cat. Emmett climbed the tree to get his cat, and then throws him down into the waiting arms of my nephew, Milton Parker. Emmett didn't see the danger in his action, but Milton felt the danger. Scratches all over his face. After enjoying each other for 2 days uninterrupted, Monday was the beginning of the cotton harvest. Emmett asked my dad if he could go with us to pick cotton. Dad said, sure. Emmett lasted one day. He came home, and he wouldn't go to my dad, but he went to my mother, and he said, Aunt Lizzie, I can't stand the heat. And that ended his cotton picking career. So he would be at home all day with no one to play with or talk to. When we got off at sundown, he wanted to go somewhere. Wednesday, August 24th, 1955. We went to this little town of Money, Mississippi. It was 3 miles west of where we live. It was dusk dark when we arrived in Money. My brother Maurice, 16, was driving. Wheeler and Emmett were in the front seat. I was in the back seat with Roosevelt Crawford, a neighbor of ours. Maurice parked the car a little north of Bryant's store. We walked over to the store to greet the other boys that was in front of the store. Wheeler went in to purchase some knickknacks. Emmett followed behind Wheeler. Wheeler paid for his items and left Emmett in the store alone. Immediately, Maury sent me into the store to be with Emmett. Emmett was in the store alone with Mrs. Bryant for about a minute. While in the store, Emmett said nothing out of line. He paid for his item. We left the store together. Mrs. Bryant came out behind us and was walking towards her car. For some unknown reason, Emmett whistled at Callan Bryant. This is what he did. It scared us half to death. We couldn't get out of town fast enough. Maurice driving as fast as he could down the road. Thinking someone was chasing us, Maurice stopped the car and everyone except me jumped out of the car, ran down through the cotton field. I laid down in the back seat. The car behind us was just a neighbor going home. When they came back to the car, this is when Emmett begged us, please, please, don't tell Uncle Mose what I've done. I don't want to go home. We were having so much fun. Why did he whistle? I think he just wanted us to laugh. Not being mannish or fresh. To him, it was just a joke. He saw no danger. Only after he saw our reaction did he realize the danger he had put us in and himself. We were in that town less than 20 minutes, contrary to some of the horror stories I have read about. These are some of the horror stories I've heard. That Emmett was showing us pictures of his white girlfriend. As the story goes, Maurice and I, his cousins, dared Emmett to go inside the store and hit on Mrs. Bryant. Many of you have seen this on Eyes on the Prize or in the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. This is not true. There was never any dare by anyone. I have said it once, I will say it again. If we had dared Emmett to hit on Mrs. Bryant, we would be just as guilty as the one who killed him. The rest of the myth can be found in Simeon's story, including a portion of my dad's testimony at the trial. James Hicks, an African-American writer who covered the trial for the Washington Afro-American Press, claimed that Dad stood up, pointed at the defendants, and said, "Dahi." That's not so. Dad pointed and said, "There he is. And there's Mr. Bryant sitting next to him." We were told that we'll hear some more about what happened in Money. Thursday passed, nothing happened. Friday passed, nothing happened. Saturday, we forgot the incident. Saturday was the greatest day of living on a farm in Mississippi. This is when we would go to Greenwood and let off steam. I asked young kids, I said, "Can you have 6 months worth of fun in one night?" Some said no. I said, "I think we had 6 months worth of fun in one night in Greenwood, Mississippi." I didn't know this would be the last night that we would share together. About 2 a.m. Sunday morning, after spending Saturday night, August 28, 1955, Roy Bryant, J.W. Milam, the other man, came to our house for the purpose of teaching Emmett a lesson. We had been to Greenwood that earlier part of the night. We arrived home about 1 a.m. Emmett and I was fast asleep. Then I heard loud talking coming from the bedroom where Wheeler and Maurice were sleeping. When I opened my eyes, I saw two white men standing at the foot of my bed. They told me to lay back down, go back to sleep, ordered Emmett to get up and put his clothes on. At the time, I was 12. Emmett was 14. About this time, My mom came into the room. She began to plead with Roy and the other man, who was a stranger to us. I knew Roy Bryant as the owner of the store and the husband of Carolyn Bryant, the white lady Emmett had whistled in money. Mom offered them money to leave Emmett alone, but they proceeded in the abduction. She begged them to no avail. They marched Emmett out of my bedroom, took him to a truck, and asked the lady in the cab of the truck if Emmett was the right boy. Her answer was, he is. Then they drove off with Emmett. We never saw him alive again. He was beaten, tortured, was killed, shot in the head with a 45. All because he whistled, 14 years old. His corpse was thrown in the Tallahassee River. His body was found 3 days later, August 31st, 1955. Only 14 years old. The killers were arrested after we told the sheriff who they described the men. They were brought to trial within a month. Actually, the trial began September the 19th, 1955. Dad and I attended the trial every day. I was a material witness. The ring that was taken off of Emmett's body, I was the one to identify that ring. Dad knew that he was putting his life on the line along with his three sons. He made up his mind. A man has to do what a man has to do. He said, I know I'm going to testify. Whether I live, I don't know. The verdict was unjust. The killers was released. There was much rejoicing among the segregationists at the reading of the verdict. Two white men and all that helped them had gotten away with killing a 14-year-old black boy for whistling at a white woman in Mississippi, August of 1955. When a murder takes place, either the murderers or society must pay. The murderers don't pay. Society has to pay. Crime rates goes up, property taxes goes up. J.W. Milan, Roy Bryant did not pay for what they did to Emmett, but the state of Mississippi had to pay for it. Someone said, how did Mississippi pay? How many CEOs refused to relocate their companies in Mississippi because of that? Only eternity will be able to tell us. That's part of the story. Someone asked me, why is this story still alive? And my response, it was the verdict. The verdict had been guilty. We would have forgotten it by now. But it was the verdict. That's Jim Crow. Let's not let that happen again. Your lawyers in here, be good lawyers. Be just judges. Be the best you can be. Like this. The Bible says, love one another. Will you do that for me? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Simeon Wright, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. You start your story off by telling us about the Jim Crow system in Mississippi, which was throughout the South, correct?
The Jim Crow system, what I was raised under.
Yes, sir. Everything was segregated. So for those of us either not from that era or not from the South, can you describe this more for us? What was it like for you to go to a movie theater, like you talked about, and have to go through a separate door or sit in a different part of the theater?
Believe it or not, we were a little rebellious. We refused to go there. We would go to the other theaters, but we wouldn't go to the Paramount because we didn't want to sit upstairs. And looking back, that's the best place to be. But there was four prongs to the Jim Crow system. One of them, you didn't have the right to vote. I heard my dad talking about the election in 1952, I believe, Adlai Stevenson and Eisenhower. I didn't know he couldn't vote. He couldn't vote. We didn't have equal access in the job market, civil or public. We just didn't have it. We didn't have equal opportunity in education that was denied us. And as I look back, I knew why. It wasn't because I was black. The landowners had free labor, and they didn't want to give that up. They would kill us before they give that up. And this is Jim Crow as we know it. Of course, we all live together in Mississippi, white, blacks together. If you live on the farm, I don't know, neighborhood, because our neighbors was white. The night that Emmett was kidnapped, my mother ran to the straw boss to get help, and he wouldn't help. And you'll find in the book, one of the things I regret, one of the things that really caused me to reflect, I said, we had no one to help us. Not even the police. The sheriff testified for the defense. That is something. So that's Jim Crow. I don't have paperwork from Mississippi, but I have paperwork from Alabama where it was against the law for us to sit in here together. It was against the law for us to play ball together. We couldn't do anything together. That was Jim Crow. That's what I was born under and raised under. That's why it's so important that we encourage our kids to get a good education and get into the system to help change the evils of racism. It's still there, but it's, when I was a kid on racism, it was in your face and nothing we could do about it. Now it's kind of subtle. It's like a water moccasin. What do you mean by that? If you ever have seen a water moccasin, you'll never forget him. You'll never forget him.
I love the story of Emmett and the cat rescue that you tell in your story. Are there other funny stories like this that happened while Emmett was there visiting?
Well, the story is not really fun, but it has to do with the animal. My brother Maurice ran over the night that Emmett was kidnapped. My brother Maurice ran over a dog and killed the dog. And Emmett just broke down and began to cry because he's very, very sensitive, very sensitive. But he was an original thinker. I've learned that this same cat, Jason, you know, he lived about on the second floor. So the drop is maybe 8 feet. So he would take Jason and he would drop him out to see what he had land on his feet. So he was an original thinker.
If I understood it correctly, it took you almost 50 years to write about the abduction. Is that right?
50 years plus. I wouldn't talk to the press. I wouldn't talk to anyone because any reporters in here, excuse me, reporters, but there's something about a reporter. He's not going to tell the truth, save his life. And I said, I refuse to talk to them. I would tell them the story, and then they would go back and get something out of history and couple it with my story. I said, I get so angry. My wife said, write your own story. If you want the truth, I'll write your own story. Mm. And Keith Beauchamp was a black filmmaker. He hounded me. I wouldn't talk to him. And finally, men, listen to your wives. Most of the time, they got it right. She said to me, said, why don't you talk to him? Said, if he was a white filmmaker, he would lay across your threshold until he got the story. And I began to talk to Keith Beauchamp. And I began to open up. Now I can talk about it without breaking down and crying. But at first, some things that happened that night with my mother, the press doesn't know that because I wouldn't talk about that. I'm glad now I never told the press what happened the night that Emmett was kidnapped. Even one of my schoolmates in Illinois, when she read Simeon's story, she said, I didn't know that. I said, I didn't talk about that. I just began to talk about it 50-some years later. My wife didn't know it.
You now travel across the country and speak and do presentations for school children. What's the number one thing that they ask you?
Where was the police? We had no protection under Jim Crow. That's just one of the saddest part of this. The police could have put a stop to it, but they didn't. They didn't do it until they were forced to do it. I suppose it's similar now. It's like that in Chicago. Where's the police? They're not going to show up if it's black on black. They won't do it. It's sad. But after tonight, we're going to change it in North Little Rock.
All right, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
I think that this was probably one moment that led to another moment that led to more moments that became important in the civil rights movement. What do you think was the moment that really sort of gained momentum and made that swing?
The moment that changed the civil rights movement? I can tell you what happened to me prior to the kidnapping and the murder of Emmett Till, we didn't resist. Whatever was thrown our way, we took it. We didn't fight back. After that, even at the age of 12, my attitude changed. I said, they're going to kill us anyway. Might as well fight back. So that was the motivating factor. And when Mamie, my cousin, Emmett's mother, showed his picture to the world, the North began to see the effect of racism. They saw the hatred behind it and those that could have stopped it, and they did nothing till after that. Then the police and the judges began to do their job. But our attitude changed after that.
I just wonder where the phrase Jim Crow came from. Do you know? Is that a particular person or?
No, the first time I heard it was from my mother. She was on a train, and I guess two of the white patrons got to arguing about something in Jim Crow system. That's the first time I heard of that. But we know what it means, and it stands for separate but equal. Now, why they call it the Jim Crow, I don't. That's a good question. Next time I see you, I'm going to have an answer.
What is your formal and public education, and what challenges did you find trying to get an education?
Well, my formal education started in the cotton fields of Mississippi. Let me tell you about the cotton fields. If you are in the cotton field, you got two choices. Now, there are only two ways out. Only two ways out of the cotton field. Get an education or go to the military. That was our plan. And I knew that in order to negotiate in this world, I had to have an education. I finished Argo Community High School, 1962. I went through a 5.5-year apprenticeship program, pipe fitting plumbing, for Reynolds Metals. I worked for them 28 years and 10 years construction as a pipe fitter. I still wished I had gone to college. If I had stayed in Mississippi, I believe I would have gone to college to get away from that cotton field. And I graduated from Moody Bible Studies course in 1999.
Mr. Wright.
Yes.
I was there, not in Mississippi, but in Arkansas when that happened. I don't think, unless anybody is my age, could we begin to understand how terrible you all were treated.
Mm-hmm.
It's as though you were not a human being. So you were something that we used, that people used, especially in the cotton fields. And if it makes any difference to you, it changed my life. I went off to college and never came home until this year. So I just want you to know that all those times that you thought nobody listened, we were all listening, but we were scared too.
Oh, yes, I know.
But I do want everybody to realize that when you talk about what education he had, there were no schools for you all. Maybe you had two textbooks per grade for 30 students, 60 students. It was so pathetic. I can't apologize for that. Like you said, it's all done. But the world has changed because of this.
Yes, it has, ma'am. You don't have to apologize. When I speak to the kids, I ask them one question. Because I said, when we left that trial, I looked back at them rejoicing, and I said, we had no one to help us. I asked the question, I said, if you had been there, would you have helped us? Or would you have been afraid? Because a segregationist, he doesn't care what color you are. If you cross him, he'll kill you too, white or black. Oh, there's some bad, we ain't got no segregation here tonight, do we? Okay. They were tough, and the laws wouldn't bother them.
Wasn't this case recently reopened? What prompted that, and what was the outcome of that?
Actually, Keith Beauchamp, the untold story, Emmett Till, he dug up evidence that the gun that was used, actually, they found the gun. The gun that was used to kill Emmett was issued by the military. And because of that, the federal government used that door to come in and do a federal investigation. And during the process, the state of Mississippi told us, said, we will not reinvestigate this case unless you prove to us that the body buried in Burr Oak Cemetery is Emmett Till. So we had to exhume his body. We did a mitochondrial DNA, and we found out, well, which we knew all the time, but we proved to Mississippi that definitely was Emmett Till that was killed, taken out of Tallahassee River. Because the defense said that wasn't Emmett, that was a grown man.
Mr. Wright, just a statement for the radio audience who can't see you, right behind you 57 years later is this our first African-American President Barack Obama's painting. So it's a pretty amazing night, 57 years after the incident, to have you talking about it with Barack's image behind you. So thank you.
Can I comment on that? August 28, 1955, Emmett was kidnapped. August 28, 1963, Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech. August 28, 2008, Senator Barack Obama accepted a nomination as the president of these United States for the Democratic Party. Isn't that something? All occurred August 28th.
Thank you so much, Simeon Wright, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Simeon will be signing and selling books after the show, and more can be found out about his book, Simeon Speaks, An Eyewitness Account of the Kidnapping of Emmett Till, at simeonwrightspeaks.com. So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, AY Magazine, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. Our bluesman is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.